Dun, 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 dun.
Boom, boom.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to season four, The Wicked Years. I'm Tara.
And I'm MK. And we are your hosts of Down the Yellow Brick Pod, a Technicolor Pod Squad community devoted to preserving and peeling back the curtain on the wonderful world of Oz.
This season, though, we have developed an allergy for water, but definitely not one for high broom belting, because we are deep diving with Gregory Maguire's 1995 revisionist exploration, unveiling a corrupt land of Oz in Wicked, the life and times of the Wicked Witch of the West, including the subsequent series to follow, and of course...
The 2003 blockbuster Broadway musical of the same name, currently being adapted into a two-part film for release in November 2024. Do you know about it?
Consider this your Green Girl prerequisite course to soothe the long, long waits.
Off the pod, feel free to follow our Insta at Down the Yellow Brick Pod for a visual companion, as well as our Patreon Pod Squad, where we continue the escapism and entertainment with a range of bonus content, including exclusive episodes, musical covers, monthly hangs, and behind-the-scenes vlogs.
As a community-funded podcast, our patrons are truly our backbone, our people, so consider joining our rainbow of a pod squad today. More perks and live events coming soon. Patrons are the first to know.
Now, may the world of Oz continue to be a bewitching escape in bewildering years, nostalgic and nuanced, and a magical refuge where two gals living in New York City can defy gravity with wonders like you.
Ain't no one gonna bring us down, baby.
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome back to Down the Yellow Brick Pod. MK here, joined by our beautiful Tara Tag. Hey, Tara.
No guests.
No guests today.
No guests, which is like sad and also kind of nice to not feel like I need to not be in pajamas at this hour.
We can just be ourselves. You are
not
welcome here.
Not that I ever really, if you know, I've been in pajamas for guests too.
I feel like it's a safe space.
It's a safe space.
That's what we're here to do, is be comfy cozy.
It's pouring out right now, too.
It is.
I was living for my Joel Grey on the Colgate Comedy Hour 1950s coffee with this rain.
I woke up and was like, oh, that's always a weird feeling when you didn't know it was going to rain.
I love, though, like, rain makes me want to stay in and read and, like, research.
Of course. That's all
rain
I want to do.
Rain means read research to me. I'm like, cool.
Read research.
So I was really falling down rabbit holes, baby.
I can't wait to hear about it. Okay. I'm really excited for the scene. I'm excited to get into our song, Sentimental Man, not our guests, Sent Men, as we
are coming
say,
up.
who are incoming soon. And I'm excited to talk about Joel Grey. So going
I can't even wait. Hold on. I can't even tell you how many times Em would be like, okay, so we have Sentimental Man this week. I was like, we're interviewing them again? Like, I literally kept getting lost.
I'd be like, girl.
I was like, wait, what do you mean? I was like, they're coming back?
That means they marketed their name well. Like,
they did. I think them first over the musical.
Yeah, you think of them before the song. Well, I was thinking of this moment in the show, which we'll get into, obviously, but it's where Elphaba finally does meet the wizard. And there are these themes of a father figure, of wanting to be a father. Obviously, that's a part of the wizard's character.
Yeah,
deeper entrenched. So I feel like we haven't really talked about this, but who are some of your father figures in your life that are like, I know, that are like your role models, either from childhood or currently? I don't really think about this very often.
I got a presence, my little shop of horrors, Mr. Mushnick, Buzz.
Aww.
Buzz felt like my dad and like my best friend at the same time, like while we were on contract. And I freaking love that. Like, he was super fatherly and like
oh, when you get home, make sure you file for this and this and this, since like we were, you know, before going into unemployment again. Yeah, like he is a wizard when it comes to like understanding the operations of equity. He like knows every rule. So he was so helpful with that. And also just like, I loved our time together. We played chess before show, and I loved that. And I beat him, and I loved getting to make fun of him the whole rest of the day, knowing he'd be like a great sport about it and like just go with it. Like a comedy team, you know? Yeah, I would have to say I just really adore him, and I love his wife, Lori. Like, they're a part of my life now, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I would also say, like, I felt this way about Lenny Wolpe, who played the wizard, who's the original wizard in readings for Wicked when I did producers way back when at the Malt Jupiter Theater. He was such a sweetheart as well. So I'd say those guys, the guys who've been in the business, like I love working with like guys who've been in the business who have worked like every odd job possible, and yes, they love sharing their stories and they love to laugh. They love to make you laugh. Like those are my favorite. Those are the kinds of people I gravitate towards. And my actual dad, Tony Tagg, is that kind of a spirit. Tony. He loves to make people laugh.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's what I like I gravitate love that. Towards. What about you? Oh my gosh, this weirdo question.
I know, isn't it funny? Because we're always like female power authority figures. And I was like, what about like
I'm a daddy's girl though.
I am totally a daddy's girl.
I am a daddy's girl, yeah.
100%.
Literally had a necklace that said it. Had merch.
I had the swag for sure. Oh, my dad always calls me his first little blonde girl, even though, like, I'm not blonde anymore, but I was as a kid, and I'm the first daughter of three.
You're like,
I'm brunette. First. I'm brunette now. No, what you were saying about, like, a funny, kind of comedic, lighthearted energy, I feel like a lot of, I was just thinking of, like, my little uncles.
Abbott and Costello energy.
Yeah, like, all my uncles, that is their vibe, is, like, ha, 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 you know, like, teasing, very dad jokes, but you love it. My dad is hilarious because he, at first, comes across as this, like, very quiet He comes across as like a very quiet person, maybe even shy at first. But then once he knows you or he opens up to you, he is like the silliest, smartest, wittiest person I probably know. And very sweet and sensitive. Yeah. Yeah. It's really sweet.
My dad takes a second to open up.
Yeah.
He's like kind of quiet. And this is how I am, actually. Like I could be kind of quiet at first.
Yeah.
Unless I feel like I need, like, sometimes I feel that pressure of having to, like, stir conversation or, like, just, like, be hostess-y, even in, like, you know, like, when you're new in a situation, you're like, oh, I don't know this person, like, how much do I speak, all that kind of stuff. If I feel like the other person has that handle on leading the conversation, I like to be the quiet one. But if I feel it's not happening, I'll, like,
you're like, all right, here I am.
Yeah.
Here I
am. But my dad, he tends to be very quiet at first. And then it's like, once you've made him feel comfortable,
he's off to the races.
Yeah, he's unstoppable.
Yes. I love that. I'm also thinking of my grandpa Schrader, who is just like the most warm, friendly. He, like, to me is the Schrader, like, vibe. He's just very extroverted. He's the patriarch of the family, darling. Like, he remembers people's names that he's met maybe one time. It's pretty insane. And he just has that, like, very gentle, huggy energy. So I feel like my bases are covered with, like, all these people in my family. Like, you got the funny, you got the warm, you got the quiet, you got the smart, you got the street smarts. And it's great. It's
I love it.
I was just thinking of that since it's the theme of, you know, this character, as well as Joel Grey, a big part of his life. Father to none other than Dirty Dancing's Jennifer Grey.
Nobody puts baby in the corner.
Which is wild.
And a chef. He has a son who's a chef.
And a chef. His son is a chef. Yeah, no big deal.
No big deal.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that little rabbit hole. Well, listeners, we'll see you on the other side as we get into our first wizard scene.
I can't even hum this song.
I don't know how that was even right. I don't know how it goes.
See you there.
See you there.
welcome back to scene 13. Sentimental man. He's a sentimental man. He tells you what he is. Are you going to buy it? Are you going to believe it? Who knows? But here we are. Before we get into our bullets, I just wanted to bring up, we got a nice message from one of our pod squatters, Lauren, breaking down some I'm not that girl magic, because she went on down a rabbit hole based on whether the actor decides to take the note up at the end. So I want to bring up what she found out, because she was deeply fascinated in this. So Lauren, thank you for sharing this with us, because I think what you shared is super cool. She starts talking about how we mentioned Lindsay Heather Pierce taking the note up when we saw it, which Lauren actually was at that performance that we were at, which was Heather Pierce's last show back in 2022. Aww. And she wanted to follow up because she is fascinated by this choice. And she's heard several recordings from pre-shutdown to reopening and well into January of 2022. And in those recordings, Lindsay Heather Pierce sings the original note in all of them. So it's like, okay, what changed? Like, why is she now taking this up? So Lauren went on a bit of a scavenger hunt of like, okay, why the choice to opt up? Eventually, she says, I went out looking for these audios just to research this. It seems that right around when Brittany took over as Principal Glinda, that's Brittany Johnson, is when that changed. And she started taking it up. And she starts sharing a little bit about like, why, like what's the headcanon around that? This, maybe it was a choice the two of them came up with, so that perhaps the note packs a bigger punch when Glinda sings it in the reprise, question mark. Elphaba sings she's not that girl, but the song ends with a tinge of hope. If it goes up, like, can it end with hope? I mean, that's the real question. Does it not have to end with hope? Can it end with hope? I think we kind of left that last week being like, I guess it's actor's choice, right? Like, do we want to end with hope? Do we not want to end with hope? Whereas Glinda really is not that girl. Like, she actually is not that girl. And at the end of her reprise, being that low note, sort of singing that low note, sort of cements that. She also heard Talia taking it up with Brittany, which is also interesting. Talia would go on to replace Lindsay Heather Pierce on Broadway. So this is actually like recent casting. This is Talia was the last Elphaba before our current Elphaba, Alyssa Fox. So she's like, this is kind of reinforcing my theory that Brittany Johnson has something to do with this.
It's all Brittany.
And I was like, I freaking love it. I love these like headcanon-y theories. And she also said, like, I acknowledge it's a bit possible. Maybe it is to make the role a little bit easier for the green girl, as there's literally nothing else that could maybe help that. But the dramaturgical rabbit hole was intriguing to her, and I agree. So thank you so much, Lauren, for, like, going to recordings of other casts just to see, like, oh, she could do this. No, like, it's not that she can't do. I think what Lauren is solidifying in this message is it's not because some of these Elphabas can't sing the note. So it's like, then why?
So she said that once they started working with Brittany, like, it changed.
It's Brittany's fault.
It wasn't Brittany, bitch. It's Brittany, bitch. I love that. That makes me think after we saw Lindsay's show, I was also thinking, like, if I was in that situation and it was her last show, if I was feeling any bit of, like, emotional, I feel like that low note would be really hard to sing.
First thing to go for me when I'm A, emotional, B, gonna have a laugh attack.
I feel like that's like maybe an interesting thing to throw in there too.
When we were,
I'm gonna cry.
Em and I were recently recording our Stephen Schwartz medley that we made for our Patreon feed, and I kept doing, we have a little bit of When You Believe for Prince of Egypt in there, and I kept doing, When Hope. Though hope is frail, I'm not that girl.
Honestly, all of his songs like overlap so well.
It was so funny to me, but like I couldn't stop laughing, and when I would laugh, I couldn't hit it. I was like, I can't get that low when I'm laughing.
I think the low notes, they take a lot of control.
I just think it's like, I don't even know what it's like. Not that it's hard. It's just like more like trusting low. Like I think that's what it is for me. I'm like, I have low notes. I can go pretty low with my voice,
but sometimes they are not there.
I think that's the same for me with top notes as well. Like I have them. Yeah. It's trusting it.
100%.
Yeah.
That was great. Thank you, Lauren. Love it.
Thank you, Lauren. Well, let's get into this scene. We have brought back our traditional three bullet points.
Here we go.
I'm going to let you choose. Do you want to start or do you want to be the grand finale of bullet points? Overture.
I'll be the overture. Okay. I'll be the prologue overture. You can be our defying
I'll
gravity.
Be exit music. Finale.
Great. Love it. I feel like mine got long. Okay. Anyway, we're not commenting on that.
There's a lot, though. There's a lot of detail.
There is a lot in this scene.
Yeah. All it's a scene.
It is a scene. With a
Winnie
little
wrote.
Sprucing. Yeah, Winnie was writing.
Was writing.
Come on, Winnie.
She
Come
said,
on, Winnie.
Which is which? And I said, I see you.
Oh, you know she chuckled at that.
I she know like, she said, I'm a genius.
I'm amazing. Because
it is really good. It's a good laugh line.
Fantastic. Bullet point number one. Transition with ominous music to the wizard's throne room. As a massive head in the center of the room with glowing eyes and smoke emanating from the floor speaks in a booming voice to Glinda and Elphaba. When suddenly, the head drops and a man's friendly voice rings out into the air. Oh, Elphaba, is that you? And a graying, bespectacled man steps out from behind the head, introducing himself to the two awestruck witches, Elphaba sharing how happy she is to meet him, and the wizard sharing that that's what he loves to do most, make people happy. Bullet point number two.
I'm smiling. I'm happy.
She's smiling. She's happy. Bullet point number two. I am a sentimental man.
I'm not that.
You're welcome. I don't, it's low. The wizard sings of how he always longed to be a father. A little bit like out of the blue. Okay. And he longs to raise
like,
Elphaba.
Come in hot. Like
he's like,
hot.
Hello.
Yeah.
I would like to be a father. It's like, wait, what? And he longs to raise Elphaba to new heights and soon shares that she must prove herself. Ooh, prove yourself, calling for Madame Morrible, his new press secretary. Get
promotion,
it.
Promotion, Biddy.
Come on. Come on, Madame. Calling for her to bring the book. The book. Introducing his monkey servant, Chistery, who longs to fly like the birds he watches all day. Perhaps a levitation spell is in order. Glinda is awestruck at the book, which turns out to be the Grimmery, which Morville does not allow her to touch.
It's so
but
good.
Hands over to Elphaba.
I just, while you were reading that, I was like imagining Madame Morrible having like a promotion party, like in like
promoted, like a
in
banner.
Like the teacher's lounge, like the professor's lounge at Shiz, and they're all like kind of happy she's leaving.
They're like, yes.
They're like, thank God. But she like threw it and she bought the cake. Like no one threw it for her.
She like threatened people if they don't
show
up. She's
like, it will be so hard to leave you all. And they're just like, and they're eating cake. And they're like,
that's
happy she's leaving.
She may have poisoned.
She could have. I don't trust her.
She may have. We don't know.
Her fishy lips.
Fishy. She's fishy. I'm watching Drag Race and that's like a way to describe a queen is she's fishy.
Also, like, her lips are drag queen lips. Like,
100%.
How she, like, paints
this
them.
Whole makeup, yeah, is perfect. Mm-hmm. A drag queen should do Madame Morrible. Like,
it's got to be done. I'll find
why
it.
Why has that not happened?
Okay. It'll be on the Instagram this week. Look out.
It'll be there. We'll find it. Bullet point number three. Elphaba down center stage. What funny writing. Morrible says no one can decipher it, but Elphaba quickly begins chanting, Ate Tate, as she and the wizard sing in counterpoint, Les Mis style. Chistery lets out a pained shriek, sprouting wings.
Chistery.
Morrible sharing to Elphaba's horror that the spell cannot be reversed. Elphaba realizing quickly that the wizard and Morrible planned all of this, as he reveals a horde of monkeys with wings at the back of the throne room, his new spies. Elphaba crouched downstage, spewing, You have no real power. Running out of the room, Grimmery in hand, as Glinda promises to bring her back, running after her, the wizard getting on the mic to call his guards to bring the fugitive back to him.
Fugitive. Words.
There's a fugitive.
Well, I'm like so struck by that word because it's so specific and it's created in an instant. So, okay, she's broken the law. She's done like... She hasn't. She truly hasn't done anything. But like those words are gonna start leading us to the not the reclamation, the claiming of witch and wicked, which is crazy. Okay, bullet point time.
Woo-hoo!
Bullet point one. It is time for Elphaba and Glinda's appointment with the wizard, who introduces himself in the MGM bomb fashion of an enormous mechanical head, intimidating our girls in his monotone barks, but immediately dismantling the domineering ruse when the wizard learns it's Elphaba Throp in the throne chambers, coming out from behind the metaphorical curtain to entrance applause. Thank you, thank you.
Woo!
Bullet point number two. I love that now it still happens. Like, I watched a couple bootlegs.
It's the wizard.
It's the wizard gets entrance applause. At first, it was probably Joel Grey, but Joel now Grey. It's like the character gets it. And I love that.
Yeah.
Bullet point number two. The wizard is actually a sentimental man, sharing his good intentions with a gentle song to our star-struck roomies. Ooh. And Elphaba is beyond warmed, urgently getting to the issue of the animals of Oz being silenced. But the wizard slyly interrupts and continues to impress with a showy spell of his own, calling in Madame Morrible, now his press secretary, who the girls are astonished to see serving Emerald Queen Mother vibes with the grimoire in hand, an ancient book holding the lost language of spells that, when put in Elphaba's hands, is easily decipherable. Now, to the reversed astonishment and pleasure of the wizard and our new Madame press secretary. Bullet point number three. The wizard has revealed that his monkey servant, Chistri is a character in the books, we'll talk about that, the labor responsible for pulling all the strings and pushing all the buttons of his power trip, has always wanted to fly. I have a question mark there. Is that invented or is that true? And asks Elphaba to prove herself with a levitation spell that will grant Chistri this wish, which tumbles naturally out of Elphaba's mouth, almost euphorically, until Elphaba notices Chistri is in great pain and she is causing harm. But the spell can't be stopped, and Elphaba realizes she's been tricked by both the wizard and Madame Morrible when she sees she hasn't just transformed Chistri, but an entire army of monkeys to become the wizard's spies. Elphaba, realizing the wizard has actually no power, which he agrees to, but offers Elphaba the world, her unlimited dreams. But Elphaba says no and runs with the grimoire, causing a commotion with Glinda not wanting Elfie to blow this on her heels, and the wizard and Morrible swinging back into political face-saving action, announcing a fugitive at large, and Elphaba and Glinda continuing to flee.
Oof.
The stakes are high.
This is like we are gearing up for
I don't think there's a better lead-in scene. Like, this is so well written.
Yeah, this is great. It's like, it's well done.
I have the continuity script of MGM out right now. That's how good it is,
because
there's so many nods.
Ooh.
It's so good.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
I love it.
All right. Well, let me tell you about Sentimental Man, our favorite song.
Please. The song I can't even remember how to hum.
You can't like, even truly, remember.
I can't even
That's
sing
so
it.
So funny.
It's not there.
Da 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 da. Who always longed to be a father. That's why I do the best I can.
I also like the little vibrato.
And daughter. I love Joel. Joel's voice also is iconic. Like,
I can't.
So
I'm
like,
obsessed
with him. That's
obviously
the understatement of the year, but okay, this is from the Grimoire.
He's
like,
the
did you know Joel Grey is good?
He won a Tony Award. Lifetime Achievement. 2023.
Oh my God, when he walked out, he's so cute.
He's so cute. He's 92. You know what is wild? He was alive to have seen Wizard of Oz in movie theaters as a kid.
That's
like... Just that just like is like chills up my spine.
Yeah, 1932. Life,
yeah, it's kind of like Mickey Rooney's connection to Judy Garland when he played the wizard for MGM. Like he had a history that he could bring on stage with him.
That's insane.
Was a kid, but it's still crazy that he's connected to that time period. You know, again, like so when you're doing Wicked in the original Broadway cast, you are connected to someone who was alive when Wizard of Oz mm-hmm. really boomed. Into the
Which
popularity
really,
that we
really
now
cool.
know. Yeah.
I love that. All right. From the Grimoire, A Sentimental Man. This is what Stephen Schwartz tells us. Here the wizard longs to be a father, which is obviously very important to the plot.
You really this know number, the song.
I know that part very well. This number sets things up that are important later on. For example, the wizard sings that everyone deserves a chance to fly, and the phrase crops up in the next song. When Elphaba hears that line, it affects her deeply, and she'll repeat it later in a bitter, cynical way in defying gravity. Also, no matter how intentionally manipulative and falsely emotional the music is in A Sentimental Man, on some level, the wizard does mean it. He really wanted to be a father. He is honestly sentimental, even though he's a villain. And at the end of Wicked, when he realizes that he destroyed his own daughter, spoiler, it's so devastating to him, he's willing to pack it in and leave Oz. I know, I'm curious, like, I'm sure we'll get into
Yeah, like, what is the truth?
Yeah, what he means, because
we'll get into it.
That's why I'm like, Joel Grey is the perfect person to play this part, because he is so charming and lovable.
Yeah, his veneer is shiny.
Yeah. Yeah. You trust him implicitly, mm-hmm. I think. So a little bit about Sentimental Man and our cut song / like morphed into Sentimental Man, oh, yeah. The Chance to
Fly. Tell me.
Yeah. So from Paul Laird's book, on the original cast recording and elsewhere, this placement is known exclusively as A Sentimental Man. But at one point, The Chance to Fly was a separate song that followed very soon after A Sentimental Man. They are part of the same placement for The Wizard, but Schwartz thought of them as two songs. He stated in an interview, I basically took the two songs and mushed them together. Lyrics for both of these songs existed as early as August 2000. We'll get into this.
The lyrics are strong.
Yeah. The Yellow Brick Road 5th Anniversary included a version of each song. With A Sentimental Man first, then The Chance to Fly. And then Schwartz also has stated that he reworked A Sentimental Man after Joel Grey joined the Broadway cast, after Robert Morris, just to remind everyone, was our original, like, was Robert in San Francisco? Remind me. Yeah. Correct. So after Robert Morris, you know, left or was replaced by Joel Grey, they basically
talk about that a little bit.
Reworked this whole song. And then he made further revisions when George Hearn replaced Grey, with more revisions when Ben Vereen took over the role. So there's been like a lot of different versions. There's a folder from August 2000 with some lyrics for both of these songs. The scene opens with the wizard's verse of A Sentimental Man. It's pretty similar, but then he has different lyrics where he announces that sacrifices must be made for the greater good, a reference to his policy toward talking animals. There's a dialogue moment where the wizard asks Elphaba for a gesture of allegiance in the form of giving his pet monkey Chitterly. Apparently, Chistery was Chitterly for a moment, giving him temporary wings.
Wait, where's that from? Or typo?
It says in the form of giving his pet monkey Chitterly, changed to Chistery in later versions.
I mean, it's always been Chistery in the books. Why would they go to Chitterly?
This is what Paul is telling us.
Paul, I don't know.
Listeners, anybody know?
Yeah, that feels odd. I'm sure he wouldn't just say that.
It rang some bells. Like, maybe I'll do a deeper dive, because I was like, that sounds familiar.
Chitterly. No, but it's Chitterly. Chitterly in the actual Gregory Maguire novel. So it's just interesting that they would derive away from it. Interesting.
I don't know. Okay. I'll look into it more.
Okay.
But yeah, so he uses the word allegiance earlier on. Then the wizard would sing The Chance to Fly, comparing Chistery's opportunity to fly with the new world that the leader will make available to Elphaba. Chance to Fly continues with Glinda and Madame Horrible singing about how they are rising in the world.
Yeah, she got a lot of solos cut. We're learning.
Yeah,
that.
She really like, did.
Stop singing.
This was like a whole medley song, like with all of them, and she gets nothing now. And then this is Glinda.
Oh, Miss Elphaba.
Just speak it. Then Elphaba runs away. Glinda goes after her. This is where the wizard would then name Horrible his press secretary and tell her to announce that Elphaba is a fugitive. Then by himself, the wizard sang another verse of Sentimental Man, in which he comments that he has lost a daughter and that she must be captured. Despite his plans to arrest Elphaba, he is a sentimental man. The scene moved much more slowly than it does today.
Your actions don't align with your words.
Sir, we're confused.
But that's what I think. Isn't that like capitalism, though? Like, I feel like...
Oh, yeah, it's like...
Yeah, like, we've just created a world that's, like, impossible to maintain. Like, it requires us having to, like, be wheels that are consistently in motion and making things happen and more when, like, can't we just rest? And, like, I make jokes. I think I'm becoming an old man sometimes, but, like,
when people
talk about technology, like, the next thing, like, whatever the next thing's going to be, I'm like, do we need any more? Do I need another inbox? Do I need another way for you to like find out more about me like on social media? Like I don't need it. Like, when is enough?
I'm on my way towards my Emily Dickinson recluse life. I'm right there with you. Yeah. Well, last few points on these songs and their evolution. In March 2004, Sentimental Man had officially been dubbed, I guess, by Schwartz, the Joel Grey version, which is kind of cute. Like, it's on some of the sheet music. Like, this is Joel Grey's version.
Aww.
Yeah. And then just kind of funny, like, in October 2003, there were some pieces of sheet music.
Jeez. So he was 72 in the production. Wait, I'm just like, I had a moment. Because I'm like,
oh, he's 72.
We're hitting 20 years, right, for Wicked. He's 92. Yeah. So he's 72.
My gosh.
Maybe 73, maybe. Oh my God.
That's pretty wild, Joel. And he, when I was doing research on him, it's like in 2022, he was doing this. It's like, this man does not stop.
Well, he's also featured with another wizard legend in Tick, Tick, Boom in the legend scene with Andre DeShields.
I love that scene. Yes, it's so good.
It's so good. I need to maybe see if there's anything with the two of them together because it's also iconic for Oz history.
Oz history. Yeah, 100%. Well, as late as October 2003, Schwartz had written on some of the sheet music, I'm going to fill in chords for this later. Like, he kind of was just like, we'll figure it out, which is kind of funny. Like, there were still revisions being made here.
It's definitely a song that's just like needed for the dialogue of it.
And he's like, you know what? We'll figure it out.
Sound like soft and like, yeah, nurturing.
Yeah. And then I wanted to tell you last note about the Yellow Brick Road anniversary production. So this is thanks to Ryan J, who sent us this beautiful program.
Yes.
George Wendt sang A Sentimental Man.
Yeah.
And The Chance to Fly, which is our cut song, was George Wendt as the wizard, Kate Reindeers as Glinda, Joy Behar as Morble, and Shoshana Bean as Elphaba.
Icons.
And here are some lyrics from the Yellow Brick Road one. And this is from, I believe, A Sentimental Man. The lyrics are, I know you've come here with a plan to win me over. Please don't bother. I promise, as we say in Kansas, I'll be fair and square with you the way I otter. And there was a line where the wizard describes his parental feelings for Elphaba.
He's from Nebraska, but that's okay. It's okay.
Moment. And then The Chance to Fly has a date from July of 2002. The lyrics in this later rendition are different, but it's still the same idea. The wizard is introducing the opportunities he has to offer for Elphaba, Glinda, and Madame Morrible, and then Elphaba chanting from the Grimmery. And then there was a brief section marked romantic that the wizard sings with Morrible and Glinda, and they're both enthralled with how their lives are going to change by being associated with the wizard.
Kind of like
which I feel like is very interesting because and she is in the scene, but I feel like we lost
maybe a little bit
more of her like being enraptured by this because
she's on the side
morphed together. Yeah.
She's totally on the sidelines of the scene, which I find actually really fascinating to just kind of check in with her because this is going to be like on the actor a lot. And also she's not the focus of the scene. But she is very much half in, like she's half into the wizard spell and also knows what Elphaba has brought to the wizard's attention is also important. I don't think she's fully there yet. And like animal rights, I do think she's like going to take her time to get there, but I think she's on her way. Give her a second. I think actually Glinda's a great example of give her a second. I think she'll get there. Yeah, I think she'll get there. But I watched Brittany Johnson do this scene. And she has a moment where, like, when Elphaba's like, oh, I would like to talk to you about the animals, when she brings it up right away. And she takes a moment, which I was like, oh, I actually really appreciate that. Like, that she's like, oh, right, yeah, Elfie, tell him. Because, like, there is, like, I think she is listening to Elphaba, but she's also seeing it's not in vogue to be doing this. And she has spent her whole life training to do exactly what is told of her, to be exactly what she wants to be, you know? And she doesn't want to ruin that. She doesn't want to soil it. Spoil it.
One of those.
Just a little bit from Stevie Schwartz's book.
Stevie Schwartz, give us.
This actually calls in some of the Joel Grey casting, which I will present a little bit more from a Playbill article that came out with the recasting of Robert Morse. But anywho, so this is, we're going back to San Francisco. So they, most of the composers, most of the creatives took about a 1 week vacation after San Fran closed, and then they reconvened in early July of 2003. And they would say, "There's no rest for the wicked." That's what Stephen Schwartz said, because there's so much to push through and get done. And this is when all the recasting that we talked about happened, with Robert Morse being replaced, Kirk McDonald as Bach being replaced, and John Horton as Dr. Dillman being replaced. And it says here in Defying Gravity, they had asked Grey 2 years before, but he was busy, to take on the wizard and didn't take it seriously. But then he was told about the father aspect of the role, the I am sentimental man who always longed to be a father. That's why I do the best I can to treat each citizen of Oz as son. And there's a little pause there, or daughter. That sounded interesting to me, reports Grey about the Wizard of Oz character. That he never had that experience of fatherhood in his life, and here he is in a very alien land. So over dinner with Joel Grey one summer night, Schwartz and Holtzman discussed his ideas for the role. He asked a lot of questions, Schwartz explains, and it made us think we could write him more Kansan, and then subsequently sprinkled some American sayings into his part of the script. Grey also suggested he should dance with Elphaba as part of the staging of Wonderful, which we'll get to. The wizard was becoming more likable, which is actually really great. That kind of goes along the lines with all of our, the best kind of wizard interpretations are where he is likable, but also he's still a humbug, a likable humbug, if you will, which really suited their perspective. And this overrides, we have to say, this does override Gregory Maguire's view of him being like Hitler, because in the Wicked book proper, the wizard is kind of irredeemable. Do you agree with that, Anne? Like, the wizard is really like a scary,
much more villainous. Yeah, he's like
totally
the
big bad. Yeah, like he gives me the chills in that scene with Elphaba that's towards the end of the book, because there really is no emotion. It's very Voldemort-esque, like if we go down that route, where it's someone who has kind of, you know, lost all the luster of light
they
in the world.
Are past the point of no return.
Yes, yes. But now we have a wizard who would get caught up in the lavish attention poured on him in Oz, and who's been corrupted by fame, which is interesting. Corrupted by fame. I like the choice of words there.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Stephen Schwartz says, "The wizard makes a lot of choices that aren't very moral out of personal weakness, but he's not a bad man. He's just someone who had no business being the ruler of a country." Sound like anyone we know?
Sounds like a lot of people.
Sounds like a lot of people.
Stevie.
And just to share a little bit more on this, like, recasting, what went down, it feels very amicable. And, like, Robert Morse was also maybe not interested in coming to Broadway. Let me share that, because it's been recounted in a couple different ways of saying, like, I've heard rumors. Again, this is speculation. I don't know how true this is. You can DM us, email us if you know more, that Robert Morse was also maybe struggling a little bit on stage in San Fran with lines. I don't know if that's 100% true. I could not find any writing on that, but I heard the rumors of he had a hard time, which is something that happens when we advance in age on stage. It happens to me now in my 30s. Okay, anywho, Joel Grey steps in as Wicked's new wizard. This was in was a Playbill article in, oh my God, on my birthday in 2003.
Oh, cute.
According to a statement, Morse was uncomfortable with being separated from his wife and two children during the New York rehearsals and San Francisco performances of the Broadway-bound Stephen Schwartz show. He decided that he did not want to leave his family on the West Coast for an additional 12 months to fulfill his Broadway contract. This is all said by producer David Stone. Stone also noted that he and his fellow producer had spoken to Grey about playing the wizard when the musical was first cast. At the time, his schedule did not permit him to join us. So that's also different from what's in Defying Gravity. in here it says that Joel was just simply disinterested. So yeah, that was the announcement that was put in Playbill. And there's more in this article about how busy at work they are. David Stone is like actually kind of concocting his own wizardry, being like, Stephen Schwartz is writing new material. Winnie Holzman is clarifying and streamlining elements of her book. Joe Mantello and the design team are making staging and design adjustments large and small. Wayne has created new choreography for a major new musical number. It's just so funny. Like the words being used feel very wizardry. Very much along those lines. So that's all in this article. They also amp up the fact that Kristen Chenoweth was recently in this Music Man television adaptation as Marion. They're using that.
Which is really cool. Music Man.
So that's there. And before we get into Jolie, I can't wait to get into Joel Grey. I really fell down some rabbit holes. One thing I was not expecting, just because he's such he's got such a wealth of history, I think, in showbiz. I didn't know his family was a part of the biz.
Yeah, his dad was an actor.
He was a musician, comedian.
A musician. Oh,
okay. I have more to share. It's really cool. But this is from our friend Ryan Bunch, Oz in the Musical, performing the American Fairy Tale, in his article on Wicked, the Witch's Turn. So talking about encountering the humbug, he shares, "The wizard acknowledges his deceptions, but maintains his good intentions as a sentimental man who only wants to be a father to the people of Oz." But I think that's all. This is where I get a little like, I hate this. Like, I know what you're doing by saying that. Like, I just want to be a father to the people of Oz. You're trying to be like, that's all I ever wanted. It's like, no, you want money. You want power.
Your intentions are not so pure.
Yeah, like, I don't know. So he says that, and he says he and Madame Morrible will trick Elphaba, like we said, into reading an incantation from the Grimmery, the Book of Transformations, so that the monkeys the wizard holds in captivity grow wings to serve as his spies. Already the curtain is pulled back on the wizard's true intentions. Rather than the helpful humbug of the Extravaganza or MGM film, this is a humbug for contemporary audiences who are well aware of the Oz mythology and of being given the song and dance by politicians and the media. Elphaba is as indignant as Dorothy and her friends, who angrily accuse the wizard of his humbug on their second visit. She refuses to join the wizard's circus. I love that. I love that a lot. I love that. Also, we're able to like do a little twist on the wizard because we know the Oz mythology so well. It's like ingrained in our culture now. They were able to do this, which is pretty cool to think about.
That's cool.
Okay, is it time for
Joel? Our boo. Oh my gosh!
I believe it's a little controversial, the number. I believe 10 people to have won an Academy Award.
I was going Tony to Award bring this up.
For the same.
There are 10.
Role. Also.
Pretty wild.
Is he the only one? I think he's the only one. I'm saying this. I don't know if this is true. To have originated a role in the top 5 longest running Broadway musicals.
Out of those 10 people?
No. New statistic.
Okay.
Is he the only person, so out of the top 5 longest running Broadway musicals, is he the only one to have originated a role in more than one?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
Salivate. So oh my God, he's so cute.
Oh, he's adorable.
That's crazy. Like, he is a part of the Chicago original Broadway cast, which is the second longest running Broadway musical in history after Phantom. And he's a part of Wicked's original cast, which is the fourth.
That's kind
longest.
Of crazy. That's.
Can anyone else say this? I don't know. I don't think so. Any Lion King actors in Wicked? Maybe. Maybe there's ensemble crossovers.
There could be.
I'm going to research this. Stand by, team.
This is interesting.
I think it's safe to say for a principal, he might be the only one. But I don't think for ensemble.
But
I have a good feeling about that.
But does it count since he was in the revival?
Yeah. No, Chicago's the second longest Broadway running musical.
From the 19...
Yeah, the revival production.
Okay, got it.
It doesn't have to be an original
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's only him. Okay. I mean, Madame Giri from Phantom, there has to be crossovers of Madame Giri to Madame Warble. That has to be something. We'll research that.
Yeah, no, there's. We're going to find these people.
I don't think there's any original. No.
I don't know.
I'm going to say it. I'm going to say
it. I can't talk on it. She's saying it. Okay, well, let me tell you
about Elphaba, at the end of the scene, she says,
no. No. Absolutely not.
All right, Joel, let's do it, babe. Okay.
Please, I'm going to read you a little quote about Joel Grey.
Oh, are you?
When you first meet Joel Grey, all you can think of is cabaret. Then you get to know him, and you discover this deep river soul and dear, dear heart.
I want
to
hug him.
He's one of those old school pros, part of a dying breed, I'm afraid. Show people who are all about the work. There's an unspoken bargain among the players. We're in this together in the hokiest, come on, kids, let's put on a show kind of way. And it feels wonderful.
And Judy.
Standing next to Joel on stage, you can feel how happy he is to be there. Swept along by this completely boyish joy, you're willing to try anything and everything, and then try something else. Make a fool of yourself. Look less than pretty. Heck, I'd have let the man whip a stick out of my mouth. Who do you think said this?
Who do I think said this? Can you give me a hint?
Co-star from...
Norbert.
No.
Kristen?
Kristen. Yes. It's from her book. The last line, I feel like, is so
Kristen. I feel like Norbert really bowed down to him. Share this right off the bat, I watched... I was loving my rainy day moment with some YouTube clips of old school Joel Grey. Cause I was like, I don't think I've ever seen him perform under the age of 40. Oh,
I know. When I think of his face, it's like,
it's Wilkerman. Like he's by the time the Cabaret movie was shot, I think he is like close to 40, if not 40.
I think so.
I think he's 40. I think it was 1972? He's born in 32. That's 40 years old. So he's a little bit older. But I was like, let me go back and see if there's any clips of him. MK, I was caught under his charm. He has Ray Bolger-esque energy.
He does have Ray Bolger.
He has this way of holding himself while he dances. He is a superb dancer. This nimbleness. And also what you just said, that boyish spirit, there is no age in his soul, which I love about him. But he has this almost he's conducting the dance floor. He's conducting the stage with his dance. It's so cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to post it on the Instagram because I'm just look at our wizard.
Look at him.
I think to play a wizard in the iconic World of Oz. And I actually have to see how Jeff Goldblum fits into this because I'm he's kind of an interesting new choice.
Because
he's not from this showman background or these people who their heritage, they are deeply rooted in the business because performing was something they had to do. It was how to make money. So can I just talk a little bit about Joel's dad for a second? Because I really do think it influences who Joel is. So his dad, from what I understand, who I fell down a bigger rabbit hole, I think, with than Joel Grey, his dad, Mickey Katz. So again, also Joel changed his name. We'll talk about that from Joel Katz to Joel Grey. We'll talk about it. He started performing with his siblings because the family needed money, back in the early turn of the century. And also found out he was really, really good at picking up instruments quickly. And how this man learned instruments as a child was his parents couldn't afford it. He pleaded with his school to just find him an old clarinet. Just give me the old used, no one wants a clarinet. He got that clarinet. He went to a shop and was like, hey, I'll do this work for you. I'll clean up your shop. Will you pay for lessons for me? I think it was an uncle of his that owned it. That's how he bargained to get music lessons into his life. So just that old school, it feels like we're researching.
I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah. Ray Bolger, Burt Lahr, Jack Hilly, how they kind of got into the business. It's very much in alignment with that. So just a little bit about Mickey Katz, because I listened to some of his music. You can go onto Spotify. It's so there's something in my soul that I get really excited listening to old Yiddish music. I don't know why. My friend Ari always is like, Tara, are you Jewish? And I'm like, I don't know.
In your soul.
Can't tell you, because my family from Eastern European, they immigrated way too much. So a lot of our history is lost. And like, I think Catholicism may have been something that happened because it was forced to have happened. But again, not quite sure there. But anywho, this is actually on Spotify. This is like a little truncated about on Mickey Katz. So long before Alan Sherman and Woody Allen showered the public with Yiddish slang, and decades before the klezmer revival breathed new life into a once popular ethnic music, a little clarinetist with a lot of chutzpah blazed the trail, exposing crossover audiences to the language and the melodies of his forebears with a series of English-Yiddish parody records. Now, I will say Wikipedia holds great space for this. There was a lot of controversy with his music, if it was furthering Jewish stereotype or if it was celebrating it. I think that's the fine line parody is always straddling. Like, is this just amplifying a stereotype or is it okay to poke fun?
Like, they were talking about that at that panel at Broadway Con we went to on Funny Girl.
Yes. I mean, Fanny Brace, which Funny Girl is based off of her story, her career was made by like kind of making fun of her ethnicity, her heritage, in a way that was playful, though. It's very tricky. Like, it's a whole tricky thing. I mean, this happens all the time with Jersey people, like not in this way.
Oh, yeah. Like, of course.
Jersey Italians get this too. It's very interesting. So,
I mean, parody is a form that I think is not meant to be controversial, but like it's not meant to be easily. Oh,
it's palatable. Yeah. It's like there's something like, you've got to, I think it either works for you or it doesn't. And that's just kind of what, it's like comedy too.
Kind of like stand-up comedy.
Yeah. It's totally like stand-up comedy. So Mickey says, being Jewish was always popular in my house. He embraced his heritage from the early days of his career, which actually Joel did not. So we'll talk about that.
The only
people it wasn't popular with were those who were frightened. Among those who were displeased with him for being open about his religious persuasion was the Jewish editor of Variety. This is again like making me think about that conversation we were at, which we talk about on our Broadway Con episode if anyone wants to go back to listen to that, who reprimanded Katz for defiling the legend of Davy Crockett when the bandleader's parody, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Duvid Crockett, became a hit record. So I'm probably a Yiddish parody or take on Davy Crockett. So he's being criticized by a fellow Jewish person in the industry. Katz made a lot of people uncomfortable in the 1940s and 50s, probably his own son, I think is safe to say as well. He was too ethnic for many Jews of his generation who couldn't shed their own old world roots fast enough, and too much of a comedian for the purists, a strange hybrid of Naftali Brandwein, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and Spike Jones, they didn't quite dig. These days, Katz's legacy is glowing brighter than ever. That's interesting. With groups like the Klezmer Conservatory Band reprising his merciless parodies of such numbers as The Cry of the Wild Goose and former KCB clarinetist Don Byron, doing a full-scale revival of the bandleader's more straightforward klezmer compositions and arrangements. Not to be outdone, Mickey's son Joel Gray includes a heartfelt homage to my Yiddish papa. I hope I'm saying that correctly. In his nightclub act. His nightclub act? Is he still doing
it? Get it, Joel. I hope so.
So cool. Like, there's more on his history on Spotify. And I also got, like, a little chill. Betty Hutton is one of my, like, dames in my DNA. She's an old school comedian. She's loud as anything. She taught me how to be loud as anything. Like, she's one of those ladies for me. And Mickey was like her band leader when they went overseas to entertain the troops. And I just had like a little chill, like of like, oh, there's some of my own like histories crossing of these, of the people that I like looked up to.
This is cool that he has this big bio on Spotify. Like, A lot of times people don't get that.
No, I think it's like there is some like work being done to like make us understand like how controversial he was for the time. And like this, like it's really well done. I would say go read the whole thing. Go listen to his music. It's so much fun. Like you feel like you're at a bat mitzvah listening to it. It's really cool.
Wow. I love this.
And also, they performed together. He wrote a show that Joel was in that did not do well on Broadway, but it did well out of town, which is pretty cool.
Insane.
A Catskill type review called Borschtcapades.
Wow. Yeah, I definitely want to read this whole thing.
Oh, interesting. This is, oh, I just want to share this. For all of Katz's outlandish humor, this is said by his wife, his widow, Grace, at the time, Mickey was not funny around the house. For the most part, he was serious in everyday life. I think that's true of a lot of comedians.
Happens a lot, yeah.
He took his work seriously, and he was a good businessman, which is rare. He wasn't a clown. He saved it for the performances, the recordings. It was the music he loved, the klezmer, more so than the comedy. Hmm. He passed away in 1985. Yeah, like also like a leader of Jewish jazz. Oh, it's just so cool. I just want to like read more about
him. Cool.
Right? Like his dad was a
Thank you for presencing
badass clarinetist. Like so cool.
Ugh.
But also come on, like,
Mickey Katz.
I wanna know what you have for like, is there anything that Joel has talked about that you've seen about changing his name? We can get there. Why don't you start us off? But I'm really interested in like why
he changed his name.
Adventure is just down the yellow brick road as the award-winning author and illustrator of Neverland returns with another intricately designed RPG setting book in Oz, a fantasy role-playing game.
Wait, Tara, is this Oz D&D? And can we now finally pretend to be Dustin and Will from Stranger Things?
Absolutely, MK. While many have traveled with Dorothy Gale to the world of Oz, there is so much more to explore in Oz, a fantasy role-playing game. But know this, there is more to the land and its inhabitants than the rumors might suggest. Appearances can be deceiving, and like any good metalsmith will tell you, the only way to tell a gold bar from a yellow brick is to hit it with a hammer. So begins Andrew Kolb's Oz, a fantasy role-playing game. While 5th edition compatible like its predecessor, Neverland, Oz uses an urban setting point crawl instead of a hex crawl, full of secrets to discover via underground trains and a monorail that loops around all 4 districts of Oz. With different neighborhoods to explore, factions to join, and questions to ask like, what happened to the slippers anyway? Y'all know we're wondering about this. Players can escape to the Emerald City for hours on end.
I can't believe you just said Emerald City Monorail. How dare. Now, where can myself and gamer listeners find this game?
Oz, a fantasy role-playing game, is available via Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, linked in our show notes, and most local game stores can order it. Also, to anyone who enters our end of the season giveaway, you may win it. So stay tuned.
Can't wait to play this with our pod squad. See you in Emerald City.
Yeah, so Joel Grey, as we mentioned, born in Cleveland, Ohio, 1932. He's 91 years old. He was born Joel David Katz. And there's this article that I'll link.
He's 91. I kept saying he's 92.
His birthday. Oh, yeah. His birthday is April. Yeah, 90. Yeah, 2000. What year are we? 2023.
Yeah, that makes sense. 2023. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's this article from the Daily Beast. It's called Who the Hell Do I Think I Am? Joel Grey on Coming Out, Cabaret, and His Yiddish Fiddler, which it is a really thorough article. Like anything that we talk about, a lot of the things that I learned are from this article. And it's very briefly mentioned in this article. Like there's actually not even a quote or anything, but I'm assuming the journalist took his words and created a sentence from it. He just says that he changed his name from Katz to Grey for the obvious implications of having like a name associated with any sort of ethnicity at the time. That's kind of all.
What his dad thought of that?
Yeah. I don't know.
Like, oh, good for you. I see what you're trying to do. Or what are you doing?
Right.
I'm curious. Right.
So he knew he wanted to be in the theater from age 10. That was like his main thing always and forever. He knew that's what he wanted to do. I don't think he thought he was going to be in musicals. He was more so like straight actor type vibe.
Not with those legs.
Joel Grey, Ray Bolger. Come on. But yes, both his parents were Jewish. He made his Broadway acting debut in Borschtcapades, where he was credited as Joel K. kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. And before, I think that's a thing that you notice a little bit, maybe in one program for some of these older performers.
It's like,
they're trying out new names.
yeah, trying it out. He started his professional television career on, as you mentioned earlier, the Colgate Comedy Hour. Yeah, that's to Danny Kaye. Yeah, 100%.
Colgate Comedy Hour is everything.
Colgate Comedy Hour from 1951 to 1954.
Did you hear how my voice changes? I'm like, Eddie Cantor. I'm ready to be. Whose agent am I going to be? Talia's agent?
You're going to be Talia's. She's got a face. She's back.
I'm ready. I'm like this old New York broad.
I love it. That's all I want to be when I'm like 70 is an old New York broad.
Wait, can I share a quick story? It's so ridiculous. Please. I may have told you this already. It just is too funny. So I was teaching an event outside for my chess company at an ice cream parlor, just playing with kids on the street, which is also like
so cute.
I like encourage anyone to do things like this more, like go up to people sometimes that you wouldn't normally go up to because you just have like interesting experiences. And I think sometimes if we like, you know, remember we were talking about way back when, I think it was with The Wiz, like when you stay on your grid, like you just kind of stay on your path and you don't break it. You just like miss things. And this is totally a moment off my grid. Do I like doing events with strangers? Hell no. But like, do I find the best stories from these things? Hell yeah. 100%. Like 100%. So there's this old woman. I can't even, like, she was excellent. She was at the bus stop next to us talking on her phone.
Oh this my loud. Gosh. No.
She came over to my apartment and she said it smells. Pause. Does my apartment smell?
Oh.
She's actually like, you could feel her being like,
she's really, oh no. really asking.
She was really asking.
I wonder what the other friend end of the said.
My friend Laura and I were literally in tears. Like, we were just dying.
Does my apartment smell?
She said, my apartment smells. Does my apartment smell?
Like, I need you to tell me. And the fact this was on a bus or at the bus stop?
She's at the bus stop. We were maybe so we were loud, like 3 feet away from her, no, but she was.
I could never. I'd be
she was born for the stage, baby.
She was born. Does my apartment
projection? Does my apartment smell?
These
smell?
Are the my people I love. Smell?
Also, the comedy. Do you hear that? How her inflection changed.
Yeah, I was the inflection changed.
She doesn't even know what she's doing.
She's a natural born comedian.
So much.
These old New Yorkers.
So much eye makeup. It must have taken her hours.
I can't believe you didn't tell me about this woman.
Oh my God, she's the star.
I must know more. I must know more.
Anywho.
I love this. Anywho.
Eddie Cantor.
Eddie Cantor. She's got a face.
She's got a face.
So obviously Joel Grey's career, similar to Kristen, like I can't give you everything, but here are some highlights. So skipping ahead a little bit. We'd be here all day long. The director, Hal Prince, approached Grey to take the MC role when Cabaret was first performed in 1966. And Grey keeps his Cabaret gongs in his office. They are touchstones in the acting world, he said. He knew Cabaret would change musical theater whether people liked it or not, although it was far from an anticipated success. And he talks about like remembering the first time they performed it and the audience just was on their feet clapping and they were like, do we go back out there? Like, what do we do?
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, I would have given anything to see that original Broadway company.
I know.
And like in Cabaret, his role as the master of ceremonies is like wizard-esque, but also like he is the peeler of behind the curtain while doing it with panache and flair that you almost don't know he's doing it. That's why Cabaret is brilliant.
Yeah.
Like
the
If You Could See Her Through My Eyes number with the gorilla and that being like, oh my, I have chills. Like, making people laugh and like then the punchline at the end being like literally a sucker punch to the gut of being like, this is what you're doing to Jewish people. You're stereotyping them. Absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. Wow. But like, again, like I feel like Joel Grey has a ability to create magic and take people on journeys on stage. That is
100%
in a class, you know,
he is in a class of his own. Well, he ended up winning the Tony Award for Best Featured Actor in a Musical for Cabaret. Mm-hmm. His follow-up role on Broadway was George M. Cohen in the 1968 musical George M. He was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical and received the Outer Critics Circle Award for Outstanding Performance. He reprised his role as the Master of Ceremonies in the 1972 Bob Fosse-directed film version of Cabaret, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in March 1973.
Beat out some big things. Big people.
Get it, in that category. Get it, Gray?
Because do you know who Cabaret lost? Watershed moment. Do you know who Cabaret lost Best Picture to?
No.
I made you watch this because it's a part of my cultural heritage.
The Godfather? It's a part of my cultural heritage.
I think Joel beat out Michael Corleone. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, the actor. Michael Corleone. Oh my God, I can't speak. Michael Corleone. What is the... Al Pacino.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure he beat out Al Pacino.
Oh, wow. Get it, Joel.
Didn't Marlon win that year? For best actor? These are all good questions.
Great questions. Well, Grace says he's still close with Liza Minnelli, who starred in the film version opposite him. She's my little sister, he said. She's very complicated, gifted, and we bonded when we made that movie. She makes you want to take care of her.
She came to see him in Wicked. She did. She saw him in Wicked.
She came to see him in Wicked.
those pictures are beautiful.
Oh, Liza, they're so great. With Kristen too, like it's fantastic.
Did you melt mama?
Stop it. Did you melt mama? So as you mentioned, he is one of only 10 people who have won both a Tony Award and an Academy Award for the same role.
Viola Davis.
Now, do you know, who any of the others are?
I know Viola Davis is a newer one for Fences.
Oh. So then maybe there's 11.
I think there's 10. Yeah, or 11. I think there's actually 11. Helen Mirren is one, I think. Is she one? No. Shirley Booth for Come Back Little Sheba is one.
Shirley Booth, yep, is on here.
I'm like, who?
Shall we dance? Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, yeah, Yul Brynner is Yul one. Brynner. Is another King musical one, King and I.
The Rain in Spain.
Oh, yeah, Rex Harrison.
Rex Harrison, My Fair Lady.
My Fair Lady. I think everyone else is too off guard, like too out of it for me. Like, I'm like, I don't know.
Jose Ferrer in Cyrano de Bergerac.
Yes, correct.
In 1950.
I definitely read this list before.
Anne Bancroft in The Miracle Worker.
That's right. Another, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Paul Scofield in A Man for All Seasons, 62.
Yes, yes, yes.
Jack Albertson, The Subject Was Roses, 1965. And Lila Kedrova did it the other way around. She won an Oscar for Zorba the Greek and 20 years later won a Tony for the same role in Zorba.
Is she the only one to reverse?
Yeah.
To put her thing down?
So how many is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So then maybe Viola Davis.
And I said Helen Mirren. She's not on there.
So what did Viola Davis do?
Fences.
Oh.
She did that. She won for the film, I think, Best Supporting in both. And Helen Mirren, it's for the Queen. The audience. Oh,
well, then this needs to be updated.
It depends on when the article, I guess, came out. Because the Queen, that's not that long ago.
Okay.
And Fences is not that long ago either.
Interesting. I'll research.
Yeah, we could put
this on. That was fascinating. That's cool.
It is cool. I mean, that's a very small class of people.
That's a very small class. And Joel is very close, right, to an EGOT, because he also has...
He doesn't have an Emmy. Is he not an EGOT? Hold on. Joel Grey, EGOT. I didn't think he was, because it's not listed. But I thought he didn't have an Emmy.
He was nominated. Dang it. So he's close. He was nominated. For the Primetime Emmy Award. For Brooklyn Bridge. Just let him win!
Sondheim is in the same category. Here, let me actually read these 10 to you. This is kind of fun.
Oh, I look at this all the time.
I love this stuff. So here's the 10 stars who just need an Emmy to EGOT. Okay? Sad that one of them is Sondheim.
I know.
But like, none of this matters. Like, again, like just saying like this, I know, none of this matters and all of it matters. It's just kind of fun. I'll give you clues for all of them. You ready?
Okay.
Aida, can
Elton
you
John.
Feel? Yes. Our Jolie Joel. Oh my God. This is the greatest show.
Pasek and Paul.
Yeah. We already did.
I wish
more than anything. We already did that. Sondheim. Oh, I don't know how to give you a clue for this. He was in On Golden Pond and won the Oscar for that.
Oh,
he's an older actor, like not of our generation. He's long been past. Henry Fonda. Oh, here's a good one. Shall we dance? Dun dun dun. On a rain cloud of music. Dun dun dun. Dun dun
dun. The composer, like
lyricist, is it Rodgers or is it Hammerstein? Who's the composer? Do you know? Out of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein.
Richard Rodgers is music, right?
Yes. So it's
Hammerstein.
Yeah. Yes. Rodgers isn't on here, so I wonder if he is an EGOT. Ooh, this is like our Gershwin tune game. Okay, here's another one.
Gershwin.
The rain in Spain climbs mainly in the plain.
Well, that's My Fair Lady. Lerner and Lowe?
Yes. Just Lerner.
Just Lerner.
Just Lerner. Okay. Interesting. And then, another one. I really can't stay.
Maybe it's someone else that. Who wrote that?
Luck be a lady tonight. And also,
Border?
How to survive. No, this is what you did during the Gershwin tune.
Dang it. I always get this
wrong. You haven't learned.
Is the Lerner low? I don't know. I can't remember.
Happy to keep his dinner warm while he goes onward.
Just tell me.
I love him, Frank Lesser. He's one of my favorites.
Frank Lesser.
And another one of my favorites.
Happy to keep his
I dream. Had a dream.
I a dream it for you. Dream. Dipsy.
So not Stephen Sondheim. Who wrote the score for Funny Girl? Dun, 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 dun.
Lawrence? Who?
What are you saying? Arthur Lawrence?
Oh, Jill Stein?
Julie Stein.
What are you talking? There's too many composers, I'm telling you. Oh, that's sad. Well, it's not sad. It's really not sad.
It's not sad. Like, it's these really people not, are fine. It's not sad. I love that we always do this. They're fine.
It's so sad.
It's heartbreaking.
Oh, this is fun. Wow. Okay, I could fall down that rabbit hole because then it's like, well, who needs a Tony? Who needs an you know, all those.
I love it.
My favorite fact before we move on about that, like, I think there's only one person who has, like, doubled – has like two of every single one, like is a double EGOT.
Do you know who it is? A double EGOT?
I think they're a double EGOT.
A double? Is Liza one?
And I think they're the youngest.
Is it Lopez?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's a double one.
Composer.
Yeah. Robert Lopez.
Yeah, I think that's correct, which is insane.
I could be sort of one.
I would say, like, Robert Lopez isn't as much of a household name as, like, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Right. But, like, he's done everything that you like. You know?
Yeah, he's done everything.
He's the youngest winner to receive all four awards, as well as the fastest to complete his qualifying run in 9 years. He's the first and only person to win each EGOT award twice. That's insane. The youngest, the fastest, double.
I think Liza, we've said this before, Liza's an EGOT. So Judy's daughter's an EGOT. And she won her Tony at the age of 19, her first Tony.
Insane.
She's the youngest still to this day for leading actress.
19. It's crazy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. I love all of this.
I'm 19, all right. But I'm old for my age.
I bet Jonathan Larson would have been an EGOT.
Oh, if Jonathan Larson lived, I think musical theater would be different. There'd be way more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, finishing
back
up.
Back to Joel.
As we know, November 1995, he performed as the Wizard in the Wizard of Oz in concert, Dreams Come True, at Lincoln Center with Joel.
So he's the narrator, too.
The narrator.
With his little hat. Broadway. With his like hat from Party City.
Oh, he's like so cute. I know. He's like, hello, I'm Joel Grant.
That hat was purchased in Party City. For sure.
He returned to Broadway as Amos Hart in the revival of the Bob Fosse musical Chicago, 1996. He earned the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Featured Actor in a Musical. For Wicked, he was nominated for the Outer Critics Circle Award for Outstanding Tony, Featured though. Actor in a Musical. Not a Tony. I saw him in this. He returned to Broadway in spring 2011 right. as Moonface Martin in the Roundabout Theater Company revival of Anything Goes at the Stephen Sondheim Theater. Wow. So he was like late 70s. He was like almost 80 in that. That's insane.
Yeah. That was his last Broadway credit as an actor.
As an actor. Having previously portrayed Ned in the 1985 off-Broadway production of Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart, he went on to co-direct the Tony Award-winning revival in 2011. And then the article references a lot of this. In 2018, he directed a Yiddish language production of Fiddler on the Roof,
which
originated at the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, then transferred to Stage 42 off-Broadway. The production became a surprise hit, running for over a year and winning the 2019 Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle Awards for Best Musical Revival.
It reopened after the pandemic also for a little bit. Yeah. I'm so sad I never caught it. That's like a big miss on my end.
I saw it because I had a friend in it, and it was really, really cool. I friended it too. It was really cool to see. I bet you could watch it somewhere. But last little thing about Joel, on a personal note, in 1958, he married Joe Wilder. Who was a woman, and they divorced in 1982, but they together had two children, actress Jennifer Grey, star of the film Dirty Dancing, and chef James Grey, which I remember, I think it was a few years ago, I found out Jennifer Grey was his daughter. I did not know that. I was like, what? That's crazy. I did not know that.
I have a little something on Jennifer with her dad that I thought was interesting to present. So she had a memoir recently come out called Out of the Corner. This was, I believe, this past
year. Out of the Corner!
Yeah, Celebrity Memoir Book Club, which is a wild podcast. They break it down. I highly suggest listening to it. And I remember like listening to that episode, and there was a lot on like, I think like she had a complicated relationship with Joel, or just like I think it was Matthew Broderick's mother, while she was dating Matthew Broderick, outed Joel Grey to Jennifer and being like, your dad is gay. Like, and she's like, what? And like, there's a whole, that's in the memoir. So there's a lot of like, my dad's been
Matthew
lying.
Matthew Broderick's
to me.
Mother, get it together.
Matthew Broderick's mother.
We are calling you out.
And she talks in the book, she talks about her dad's sexuality. She says, it's really only for him. I'm so exhausted by the reductiveness but with which people want to out famous people and decide what people are. Mm-hmm. Like, who cares? People should feel good. And besides, I think that sexuality is so much more interesting than straight, bi, gay. And you know what I think about it all the time? And you know what I think about it all the time? He said, my mom was the love of his life. And I believe she was. So that's interesting. But the main thing that caught my eye in this article that was published with People to promote her book was on her name, Grey, because it was chosen by Joel Grey. It's not like it would be Katz if he didn't change it. Yeah. So she ends this article saying, there's a lot of rough stuff that happens in the book that happened in my life, along with amazing privilege, along with beautiful, caring, loving parents, with incredible exposure to great artists and steeped in culture. Because it's not one thing. It's this beautiful gray. It's not black and white. Aww. I love my name, Gray. I love my name because it's not black or white. I can't believe, like, unconsciously, what my dad chose. Hold on. This doesn't make sense, but this is how it's worded. I can't believe, like, unconsciously what my dad chose that word. That's worded a little weird, but that's what it says here, that name. Mm-hmm. He was born Joel Katz. But because of what it means, there are so many shades between black and white, maybe 50 shades. There's so much complexity in human beings, right? So it just is interesting that, like, we always talk about the gray of Kansas. We've been talking about the gray of Kansas. Gray. And we've been talking about the nuances and what's found in gray often, that his last name would represent all of that. I love that.
Well, that's also like where he, I think, exists in his sexuality, as he mentions in this article and in his book, is like, I guess if I have to choose a label, I'll choose gay. Like, I'm a gay man, but he really loved his wife and it was really important to him to have kids. And like, I think even the author or the journalist is like, does bisexual like fit? And he's like, I don't know. Like, I don't really need to figure it, like, tell everybody. I don't know.
We have to let that be okay for people.
Yeah, and that's fine. Like,
I think that's important now, like, after what we went, going through, I think, a deeper education in gender identity.
Like, let it be gray.
But
let it be
gray. Like, some people really don't also want to have, like, their pronouns be something that is, like, they don't care. And so it should matter for both. Like, if you care, excellent. Let's address you by what you care about. If it doesn't matter to you, we should also acknowledge that. Because I think, like, then that's also forcing boxes, right?
Yeah. 100%.
Even if you're forcing a non-binary box, you're still forcing a box at the end of the day. So that's very interesting.
I love him. Well, we haven't even referenced, he has a memoir, his many books, and he's a photographer as
Photographer.
It's amazing.
Who knew?
His memoir is called Master of Ceremonies. And Master just one quick little anecdote. He actually missed Jennifer Grey's birth because he was in New York for something, for
The trauma begins.
And 3 a.m. he gets a call that's like, your wife just had a baby and you should accept like this collect call because this just happened. And he's like, what? No.
Had a baby. It's a boy. Do you remember that commercial?
No.
Oh my God. I'm dating myself probably. Hello, 90s people. I think it was a commercial in the 90s for collect calls that was like trying to get in news of a birth. It was like, they had a baby. It's a boy. Like you just say it as fast as possible.
Had a baby. It's a boy. Well, that's what this was. It was like, tell him his wife had a baby. And he's like, wait, what?
Had a baby. It's a girl.
Had a baby. It's a girl. And so he like flies back, but he also mentioned that a year earlier they had had a son who passed away when he was an infant, and had like really caused some strife in their marriage.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
The grief, and somehow he's actually like, I'm amazed we even tried again. Like if we hadn't, I think we would have drifted apart much earlier, but they do try again. And that's Jennifer. And so he does go back and then he talks about, I just thought this was sweet since it's all about fatherhood. Jennifer was a very good baby and I took her everywhere with me, to the dry cleaner, lunch, the park to walk the dogs, wherever I went, always stating proudly to anyone who would listen, this is my daughter. I was enthralled by every aspect of caring for her, from diapering to bathing to giving her a bottle in the middle of the night. I was finally getting to do all those things that I had been good at as an 8-year-old. Nothing ever made me so happy and whole. Settling into family life, I was in total heaven, complete. Even if Joe was cranky, his wife, I had Jennifer.
That's rude, Joel. Don't you throw Joe under the
bus. If Joe was cranky.
Under the bus.
He did. He was like, she was cranky, I was happy. I love
him.
She
just gave birth, you idiot.
I know.
Joel, I'm coming for you.
Joel. Joel, you weren't even there for the birth, and she had to go through this crazy experience.
Shall I read, before we get into the scene, should I just read Joel's bio in the Wicked Playbill?
Yeah.
Hard copy? What?
Oh my God, I love it.
Okay, Joel's bio. And I'm also going to read another actor's bio I'm very excited by. So Joel Grey, the Wizard, received a Tony Award as the MC in the original production of Cabaret and an Academy Award for his work in the film with maybe 9 to 10 other actors. We are figuring that out. Stage, Amos Hart in the hit revival of Chicago, Drama Desk and Outer Critic Circle Awards. Give me your answer, do! Roundabout, Drama Desk nom. Harry, Noon and Night. American Place, George M., Tony Nom, Good Time Woo! Charlie, Tony Nom, Marco Polo Sings a Solo, The Normal Heart, Platonoff, The Grand Tour, Silver Lake, Cabaret, 20th Anniversary, When We Dead Awaken, Herringbone, A Fool and Her Fortune, Film, Man on a Swing, Buffalo Bill and the Indians, The 7% Solution, Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins, Kafka, The Player, The Music of Chance, The Fantastics, I forgot he was in the film of The Fantastics, Dancer in the Dark, Television, Oz, which is also just funny, Law and Order, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that's
right,
like a hint in Battle, The Scarecrow from The Wiz, Brooklyn Bridge, his first monograph, Pictures I Had to Take, Powerhouse Books, was recently published and coincided with his debut photographic exhibition at New York's Staley Wise Gallery. So that is Joel in our original Wicked bio. And I can't wait to presents. Manuel Herrera debuted on Broadway in 2001 as Tommy DeGiulis in The Music Man. Let me tell you who he was. Chistery. He is our Chistery. Followed by the encore series Golden Boy. Concert work. Mia Michaels, R.A.W. Urban Ballet Theater. I don't know if I'm saying this right. Nureyev Foundation Scholarship recipient. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. School of American Ballet, Commercials, Winter Fresh, Mervyn's Joe Boxer, Optimum Online. Thanks to mom, Corinne, and family. So I saw on Manuel's Instagram, he posted, I think, for Wicked's 19th, that I was 19 when I started working on Wicked. I'm such a fan of him because that's I got crazy. To see him in Dansin' this year, which was sadly like short-lived on Broadway. It was a celebration of what it means to be a dancer first on Broadway and just the physical expression. And it's a Bob Fosse piece that was remounted. It was incredible. And Manuel should have been nominated for things. I'm shooketh that he was not. Yeah. He was one of the like pillars of the company. He sang Bojangles, which was beautifully sung, also has an instrument on him and can dance like a god. Like felt like almost like as if like Robert Downey Jr. If Robert Downey Jr. was a dancer, that's zaddy energy.
Zaddy! Give us zaddy. Coming in hot.
But he's also OBC for West Side Story for that revival production and Legally Blonde. He was the pool boy and Sweet Charity, the revival, OBC of that. I mean, cool. So many OBCs.
Yeah.
Lots of television credits now. He is happily married and has two children. I am a fan. I am a fan. And also, just so you know, if you want, you can get a Chistery plushie. Did you know that?
Why don't I have it?
Because it's $40, babe. That's why you don't have it.
Dang it. No.
Wicked sells one, which is kind of fun. But it's so cute. The little spiked hair. I can't.
That's cute. I know. I like the spikes. Oh my gosh. Love it. Welcome in, Will. 19.
And before we get into the scene, last little thing just on my end. Chistery is a character from Gregory Maguire's book, different origin. Yeah. Let me just remind you of the origin. So he will become the head of the monkeys going into later Oz canon books of Gregory Maguire, but Elphaba finds him on her journey to Kiamiko. He's a snow monkey and she kind of takes him in as her pet to continue Dr. Dillaman's biological experiments on and to see if he can talk. And he kind of becomes like a parrot, but he never really forms thoughts in his voice of his own. So it's really fascinating what Gregory Maguire is trying to say with Chistery. And she forces the wings on Chistery. She sews them in herself because she wants to give him more power. But like, did Chistery ever ask for that? I think is always the question, right?
Yeah, right.
And that's, I think, still the question in the musical. But the monkeys are not with the wizard in the book at all. They're completely like tied to the Wicked Witch of the West from the top.
Very different.
Yep. Yeah, totally different. But like he never really learns how to speak right away. I think it comes up later in Oz books of Gregory Maguire's, unsure, because we haven't gotten there yet. But yeah, she's hoping to understand more about animals' connections to humans through Chistery.
Yeah. Thank you for presencing that.
Yeah.
Chitterly.
Yeah. Chitterly.
Chitterly. Tara, we have one tremendously talented pod squad full of healthcare workers, educators, collectors, and multidimensional artists.
Yes, we sure do. And one of those pod squad members includes graphic designer and illustrator Ashley Fletcher, whose Etsy and pop-up shop Good Witch of New York City, NYC, features fairy tale inspired clocks, prints, and jewelry, of course, including the Land of Oz.
You can find our favorite The Witches of Oz compass clock, stickers, and cards celebrating the original bomb color codes for each country, as well as a queer collection of Oz buttons and designs.
I even have tiny, wonderful Wizard of Oz book earrings. Mm-hmm. Ashley truly got both our book and movie lovers' backs in original designs.
Check out at Ashley L. Portfolio on IG for upcoming sales and festival appearances, and Good Witch of NYC on Etsy, linked in show notes.
All right, well, let's get into the scene. We're in Act 1, Scene 13. We go right from One Short Day into the Wizard's Palace. Elphaba and Glinda walk into the throne room, and they stop dead in their tracks down stage left, and they see this enormous head on a jewel-encrusted throne. So very quick for you about this head. It's in the Grimoire, and there's also this really great video that shows you behind the scenes talking to...
Hi. I'm Sean McCourt, and you're coming with me behind the scenes.
That's what it is, behind the scenes. Yep, I will link it. And Eugene Lee basically said to Bob Flanagan, our SNL designer, props master, go look at the original drawings from the L. Frank Baum book. So it's you can like best. Remember right when we see that head, you know, that's what he really based it upon. He also was really inspired by the makeup and design of Jack Haley's Tin Man. With like the jaw and the little bolts.
That's my boo.
And that's your boo. I thought of you. He made 6 or 7 maquettes of like different designs of the head. And I think is it Eugene Lee? Is like, yeah, I have one of them somewhere. I don't know which one it is. I'm like, what? I want to see it.
I want to see all of the ones that didn't get picked.
I know. So it's operated by a stagehand in the back. There's a hand grip and pulleys for the mouth, kind of like a bicycle brake. The eyes can go left and right. You can blink the eyes. The eyebrows can flip up and down using a foot pedal that you would use for like a bass drum. There's LED lights in the eyes that can change to any color. There's smoke that emanates from the floor. And there's also a way to make the eyebrows make like a clunk clunk sound when they move. And then our wizard actor stands behind and delivers his lines through a microphone. And it's really cool how they talk about how choreographed it is between the person working the head and the actor of like, and there's, I forget who it is, but there's an actor who plays the wizard and he like delivers his lines in the interview and they do a side by side of the head. And he's like, if I say, you know, if I have a booming voice and the mouth is like, meep, 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 it's not going to translate. Like right. It has to go together. And cool. The guy working the head said that it really just becomes like muscle memory and a part of your body because it's choreography after a while. So it's a really cool video. I'll link it. And I just think it's a beautiful puppeteering, really.
Yeah, like it's like a special effects, I guess, department. This would be considered.
It's like the guy that was interviewed is like props. So I don't know it, but it's like a mixture of all of the above.
Yeah. Practical effects, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, practical effects.
So we walk in, we hear, I am Oz, and Elphaba and Glinda are like a little freaked out, like what is about to happen?
The on-brand and stammering is happening, downstage left.
Very similar, like feeling.
Yeah.
I am Oz, so great and terrible, who are you and why do you seek me? And Elphaba's kind of stammering, Glinda's like, this is all you, girl, like say something, come on, do it.
Kristen says, is genius in this. Did you watch Kristen?
No, I didn't watch the chat. Actually, yes, I did.
I have always, I think I'm just going to notice this. Kristen's performance is so good throughout.
It's so good.
And like, it is so morphed now. It is so different from what we know today. Like, she's like in shock when he asks her coming up, like who you are. And she's like, when she has the whole moment to say, I'm Glinda, the gut is silent. She says it like in shock that she's being talked to, not like I'm trying to impress, which I think is now the new take on that.
Yeah.
She's like in general shock.
True, honest performance.
I love her. Anywho, sorry to interrupt, but Kristen fan.
Oh, no.
Kristen fan.
Yeah, Kristen fan.
Chenzel forever.
Elphaba says, let's make shirts. I need a mug. Chenzel forever.
Chenzel forever. What's going to be Cynthia and Ariana? You know. Grandevio?
I know. Grandevo? Grandivo.
Grandivo.
Grandivo. I like it.
Grandivo.
Grandivo. Okay, we'll make swag. It's fine.
People won't buy.
No. We will, though. She says, I am Elphaba Throp, your terribleness, and this is, and then the head sort of like goes down. And a man, you hear this voice. Oh, is that you, Elphaba? I didn't realize. And out steps. 2 entrance applause.
Yes.
Joel Grey or the wizard.
Or anyone else.
Or anybody else who plays the role.
Can I share? Yeah. Can I share just a few things on the line choices? Because it's really smart. There's a lot of nods to the original MGM script. He introduces himself as Oz the Great and Powerful first in the MGM script, not the Terrible. But there's lots of similarities. Like, Oz knows why you have come. That is in the MGM script. There's a lot of things that will come up. I've noted them as we go along, and I'll make sure to say that. But even, like, the your terribleness, like, not knowing how to address him, the, like, your wizardry, your excellency, like, all of that, it's so embedded. Yeah. Like, this is all, like, a recreation in a new sense, which is awesome. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's really cool. Yeah, it definitely feels very, very similar, but different. So he's dressed in goggles and a gray coat. He has a little mustache. Says, it's hard to make out people's faces when I'm back there.
That's crazy.
So let's see.
He never knows who he's talking to then.
I know. He's just like, sorry, I'm just talking to people.
Oh. Yeah. Like, on autopilot.
Yeah. So let's see. Which is which? Ha ha ha. Applause and laughter.
It's funny.
It's really good. I remember even seeing it recently being like, oh, that's hilarious.
Oh my God, it was so funny. I love who we saw as the wizard. I thought he was wonderful.
Yeah, he was great. He was great. Elphaba, it says she's speechless. She's too starstruck to move or say anything. He generously takes her hand for her and shakes it. A pleasure, Elphaba. And you must be, and this is a line you just mentioned, Glinda, the ga is silent. And then he gestures towards the head. He says, people expect this sort of thing and you have to give people what they want. Which is already interesting.
I noticed some differences between Joel and, like, other actors playing the wizard. He is so much more physically affectionate than others. There's, like, a little bit of distance, which I actually, I'm intrigued by that. I don't know. There's no right or wrong, obviously, but it's just like, oh, okay. Like, it's, I guess I wonder if that's up to the actor or if that staging has morphed over time.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting observation. Elphaba shyly says, I'm so happy to meet you. And he said, that's what I love best, making people happy. And then we launch into a sentimental man, where he says, I always longed to be a father. I want
what
to
if the act ended here?
Can you imagine? It would be a much different musical. It would not have the same appeal.
No, I don't think so.
Can you imagine? I am a sentimental man. Close. No Yikes. Shade, no shade to the song, but yeah, he says, Elphaba, I'd like to raise you high. Everyone deserves the chance to fly. I love this rhyme. Helping you with your ascent allows me to feel so parental.
No, the lyrics
am
are good.
A sentimental man.
The lyrics are good. I love this song for the lyrics. Like, I don't remember how it goes. Yeah. I don't need to, though. That's the thing. Like, not every song needs to be a hit. Like, it doesn't.
It just not every song needs to be a hit.
And that's
but really,
okay.
It really doesn't. And it makes sense that these were, like, two songs morphed together now. And I love his little falsetto note. I am a sentimental man. It's cute. It's very cute.
And it has that old style. Like
that old style.
Yeah,
it
the
feels
old sensibility.
Like almost King of the Forest-esque.
Well, it makes you think like the wizard probably tried his hand at vaudeville. Like,
yeah, he tried.
You know what I mean? Like he tried to be an opener or something, you know.
He threw his hat in the ring. As I was watching the Chenzel, though, because he takes like their hands. At one point, I was like, wow, we are watching three musical theater legends on stage right now.
Yeah,
like,
it'll never happen again.
This is crazy. This is a wild trio right now. And Elphaba says, oh, your Ozness, I knew you'd help. We're not here just for ourselves. Glinda says, we're not. She says, no, we're here because something bad is happening to the animals. He says, I already know why you've come.
Yeah.
Ooh, impressive. That's like a funny little moment. He says, I fully intend to grant your request. Of course, you must prove yourself first. And Glinda says, prove yourself. Like, you do it. Come on.
I love, again, Kristen's delivery.
And she's like, come on.
She's just like, yeah. Like, it's very much like she's entranced. Like, she's just so entranced by this whole situation. And it's not big. It's super small. And like, the periods are hit on her lines. Yeah. Like, in these moments.
You're so right.
Can I ask the question now of like, what is the act? Is it the sentimental man? Is that the act? Or is the showman the act?
I think the showman is the act. I think there is truth to him saying, But, I mean, it is a little weird that he just brings this up out of nowhere.
Maybe he has seconded or third or fourthed his desire to be a father for money and power. You know what I mean? It's never taken priority.
Yeah, it's always like, ah, we'll do that later. And now it's like,
Yeah, because once you, I think, are in an agreed power trip,
it's hard
like hunger addiction of sorts. Yeah, you're feeding it.
Yeah,
all your choices are going to be based off of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mattering more, like your image mattering more than having a human moment or being imperfect or whatever.
Yeah,
vulnerability.
And that's why I think it's gray, right? Because it's like, yeah, he does mean it, but
it's
your actions speak louder than words too. Like you're not prioritizing it. It's still gray. It's gray.
It's still gray.
It's still gray. She says, how should I prove myself? This is where he calls for Madame, the book, followed by Chistery, the wizard's monkey servant.
God. It's like Elphaba's like seeing like her dream family come together. Then it all just shatters.
And
like,
then it's like horrible
den mother energy. This man who's like seeing her for what she is, which her father, her real father, we know the truth of what it is, but like her. Her father back in Munchkin Land, governor. He never gives this to her. He never sees her.
I know. I think she even has like when she sees Morrible, she's like, oh my gosh, so excited to see her.
This is the best day ever.
It's really a celebratory moment.
Well, I even heard it in our bullets. Like we went from like, oh my God, what is happening? To, oh my God. Like it literally is like the table just flips over.
360.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says, I believe you're well acquainted with my new press secretary. And they're like, wait, what?
Does she bow?
Like, yeah, I've risen up in the world. That is I. You'll find that the wizard.
Go ahead.
You'll find that the wizard is a very generous man. If you do something for him, he'll do much for you, which is an interesting line.
Also forgot to mention, like, Chistery is, like, here this whole time.
Yes.
Doing all of the work.
Yeah.
Like, he's the one manipulating the mechanical puppet. Like, we get to see that. And I think that
He's up top, right?
Yeah. And that links to the top of show. Like,
yeah.
Yes. Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
You're so right.
The
you're
monkeys
so right.
are the, like, hard labor that no one wants to do.
That no one, yeah.
Yeah, just to put that in, like, words.
Elva asks what you would like me to do. He introduces Chistery. He watches the bird so longingly every morning. Morrible says, so perhaps a levitation spell. And she holds out the book.
Can't you? Like, please. Like, it's just like so. Oh.
Maybe you could do it. And Glinda's staring at the book. Is that the Grimmery?
How does she know what the Grimmery is? That's also, that struck me. I was like, oh my God, she is a smart witch. Or she is going to be.
She knows her stuff.
Yeah, she knows her stuff. Like, she's surprising. I think she does study. And again, I think Kate Farner talked about this. And like, it is in the books too. Like, she really wants to be a good, like, she wants to be a good witch.
She does.
And Elphaba has the natural skill and she doesn't. So there is that, like, I want that. Like, she really, really wants that.
Yeah. I love the Grimmery. We talked more about it in our Wicked Book episodes. If you want to go back towards one of our latter episodes, we were
getting more into it. The Grimmery is huge in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. This is our first introduction to it. Morrible calls it the ancient book of thaumaturgy and enchantments. Mm-hmm. And here we get, Glinda asks, can I touch it? She says, no.
It's delicious in the Chenzal.
That moment it's so is good.
So funny.
It's good.
It's not funny to me it's now not moving campy. Forward. It's very campy now.
Yeah. It's very much just like, no.
I mean, I don't know. I have to watch what I say. I'm like, you don't know what's happening on that Broadway stage right now. But
yeah,
like over the morphings in the more recent productions, that has been a thing that has morphed. Yeah. Become extra.
Yeah. There is an underscoring of the beginning music of Wizard and I, which is really cool.
Did that really just happen?
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
I know. It's really cool. I love it. She says, what funny writing. Elphaba's now like down center stage, which I love, just like staring at this book. And
it's like parcel tongue for Harry Potter. Like
it really is. Yeah. Because Morrible says, don't be discouraged if you can't decipherate it, dearie. I can only read a spell or two. And then all of a sudden, Ate Tate, Elphaba is reading from it. And they're like, oh my gosh. And the wizard gets excited. Chistri, what an experience you're about to have.
I don't think anyone's gotten more excited over Ate Tate.
Ate Tate. Ate Tate. This is their like moment. And they have a counterpoint where the wizard is singing, since once I had my own day in the sky, I say everyone deserves a chance to fly, while she's singing the spell. And then all of a sudden, there's like this crazy shriek from Chistri, and he's trembling, he's twitching. Elphaba stops chanting. What is it? Is something wrong? Morble, it's just the transition. Chistri, are you all right? Chistri tears at his waistcoat. Why can't he answer me? Suddenly, wings sprout from Chistri's back, which is a really cool costume effect. And the wizard says, Glorioski, which is an interesting word. And Glinda says, you did it. You actually, like, Glinda's amazed that this is happening. And Elphaba all the while. Entranced. He's in pain. Quick, how do I reverse it? You can't. You can't reverse the spells. Spells are unreversible. Morble says to the wizard, I knew it. I knew she had the power. I told you. And then this is where everything really starts crumbling in front of our eyes. Elphaba realizes she's sort of been used.
Upon, yeah.
She's been put upon. You planned all this.
Morble and like, said, this is, just to go back to our original MGM script, like this prove yourself worthy idea concept comes from the whole sending Dorothy to the Wicked Witch of the West, like this being something the wizard does. And also I think he says like back where I came from, he has that line is in here too, which is another line that we get later from the wizard in the MGM script. Just to put those little things in there, like how much of a nod this is continuously doing, even as it's going into darker territory.
Oh, so good. Morble says, you benefit from this too. And the wizard says, this is only the beginning. Look, he pulls a lever in the back of the stage, opens to reveal an enormous cage full of chattering, shrieking monkeys.
Why did he think, like, he's an idiot. I'm like, why did he's you think idiot. After everything she has just said that she would be so excited to see caged monkeys that she had not just done this to one? Like, he's literally just like, oh, this is the best. And she's like, what?
Yeah. It's the ultimate, like, you used somebody. And I always feel for Elf. It's such a heartbreaking moment because it's like, I didn't know that I was doing this.
But she probably feels guilt because...
So guilty.
We've all been there. Like, this is that moment where you just want to impress someone.
Yeah.
And she's like, I understand this language. They don't. Yes, I
can
this.
Do this.
But I can do this.
Used in a horrible way.
Yeah. So she probably feels guilt because she got kind of swept up in the whole thing too and didn't stop to think on anything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting staging with Elphaba and Chistri at the top where she's like reaching a hand out. Like she is very much like, she's very kind and like, there is like it's established well in what I think I saw more clearly in a more recent filmed version, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. But again, like the question of like Chistri, like maybe he doesn't want to fly. Maybe he doesn't even want to speak. Like no one's asking Chistri, not Elphaba, not the wizard. And I keep coming back to that. Like neither of them are asking Chistri what Chistri wants.
That's a very true observation.
And that kills me. And also that Madame Morrible line of like if you do something for the wizard, she says something along those lines.
Yeah, he'll do something for you.
And I was like, sometimes I hear a little sexual.
Oh, that's all I heard. I was like, oh.
It's like, whoa. But obviously it's getting Elphaba. It's definitely like her whole thing was getting Elphaba here. Like that was her whole thing. But there is like a little sexual undertone, which I wonder.
Yeah, they could have.
Especially right now since our wizard and Morrible are a read in real life.
Are they? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh.
Forgive me. I don't know the actor playing the wizard, but it's Michelle Pach as Madame Morrible. I love
her. On Broadway?
Yes. Michelle Pach is a hero to me. I love her. They're in the 20th anniversary.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Hold on. They just did an interview.
I love that. I love that.
John Dossett. That's her husband.
Oh, my God.
Actor John Dossett. Yeah, I'm obsessed with her. She is one of my...
Romance.
If I had to pick, like, I don't like using these words, but for lack of better words, like, she's one of my favorite underrated actors. Like, she's a Broadway actor, like, not maybe a household name actor. I saw this play at Playwrights Horizons. Oh my God, what was the name of it? That she was the lead of. And she freaking gutted me. Like, in a way that I have never, I couldn't leave my seat after wow. seeing it. I had to sit there. Because, okay. like, I couldn't move. Like, she's one of the, I don't know. She has me forever to this day. I think I reached out to her. I sent her an email. And she responded being like, no one ever talks about this play anymore. And I was like, I think about it daily. Please.
I think about it too. I think about it every day.
Michelle Pak, I love you.
We love you, Michelle Pak.
And you better be married to the wizard.
You better be married to the wizard. Get it, girl. Okay, I'm going to fly through this. Morble says, such wingspan. Won't they make perfect spies? Spies. Elphaba is astonished at this. And wizard says, smart. Maybe let's call them scouts. They're going to fly around Oz, report any subversive animal activity. Elphaba says, so it's you. You're behind it all. And he says, when I first got here, there was discord and discontent. And where I come from, everyone knows the best way to bring folks together is to give them a really good enemy, which I agree with personally.
I 100% agree.
Elphaba realizes you can't read this book at all. And this might be my favorite line from the scene. That's why you need an enemy and spies and cages. You have no real power. And she says that while she's like down on the floor and he's up. And it's just like a very interesting power dynamic. And he says, that's why I need you. The world's your oyster. You have so many opportunities ahead of you.
Yeah.
Glinda says, oh, thank you. You're Ozness. So she's still wrapped up in this. And then we get this little reprise. The two of you, it's time I raised you high. The time has come for you have the chance to.
The two of you,
which obviously is a nod to maybe Chance to Fly cut song. Mm-hmm. Elphaba says, no. And with the Book of Spells, she runs out of the room. And then there's mass pandemonium.
Mass hysteria.
Elfie, wait. I'm sorry, your wizardness. I'll fetch her back. Glinda runs after her. The wizard says she knows too much and rushes back behind the head. Morble says, don't worry, your Ozness. I'll handle it. She goes off purposefully. And we hear the head say, guards, guards, there's a fugitive at large in the palace. The guards appear. Find her, capture her, bring her to me. Yes, your Ozness. The guards stampede from the room. And we are sort of starting this next transition where we hear Glinda calling after.
Voice over Glinda.
Voice over Glinda.
It's noted. Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, there's so much here that is just so like juicy so at the end of this. I also like wonder like when did, just to let loom this question, we do not need to answer it. We also need to wrap up this episode. But to let it loom, when did the wizard show himself to Morble? When did he choose her as an ally? Like, I want more on that.
I think they've had an alliance for quite some time.
Yeah, like, but when did that happen? I'm like so intrigued because we really don't get that backstory. And I remember, I don't think I've ever said this on the pod, but I listened to something with Gregory Maguire and he said, if ever he got to write a spinoff, it would be Madame Horrible.
Yes! I was like, I want that.
Heck yeah, spinoff. In this heck whole yeah, scene, spin-off. There is like a red light that is like almost like poisoning.
The red light is
this crazy. Emerald world. Like it's really interesting. Also, like I think I presenced it in the bullet. Freaking Madame Morrible's bouge emerald outfit is like
it's so beautiful.
She is like also like she's in it for the money too. Like it's clear like that she's like. I think we all have you know those like cartoon characters that have the little swirlies in their eyes that are like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being like entranced, like she's totally, I think, in the
under the spell
of like the pompousness and like all that stuff. Like,
she's the new press secretary.
Yes, like she's so obsessed with that. But what I found most intriguing, and I think I'll end with like for my emerald of the scene is Glinda. To be honest, she's my emerald in the scene because she, I think, again represents most people. She wants to save face with the two people in power in this scene because she knows that's how you play the game and she doesn't want to hurt her friend. And she's also like, her wildest dreams are about to come true. She is in the same room as the Grimmery.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? Like, everything she's wanted is happening. So I just want to give a shout out to, Kristen for her like delivery in this, which I do think has gotten lost. And also some of Madame Morrible has gotten lost too. Like, how Carol Shelley delivers the I'll take care of it, that last line.
I'll take care of it.
Is perfect. That, I watched a bootleg recently of like, not Michelle Pak, a recent Morrible, and it was so intensely heightened and campy and like over the top that I was like, no, doesn't need to be that.
Right, right, right.
Could be like more just the text is alone chilling. We don't have to do
it
much.
It is chilling. It's a chilling scene. I feel unsettled by this scene. My iconified moment
I can't think of one for this.
Elphaba reading from the Grimoire. Like iconified, when you realize okay. like, oh, dang. And she's down center stage, which is where she is at for No Good Deed. Reading from the Grimoire. It's just like a very interesting putting those two moments side by side in my head. I think that's iconic. Realizing
good for
like,
you on that.
She can read from the Grimoire. Oh yeah.
Yeah. You're right with that. I'm like, what is the moment I think of in this scene? I was like, what is it? Mine is when the monkey music comes in from the overture that we didn't have any idea of what that meant. The like, when all that comes in, when they reveal, it's so chilling.
It's very chilling. And that red light is unsettling.
It's poison to me.
Yeah. And I think that's my episode, Emerald, is what you poison. Said about history.
Poison.
Return to Oz,
if you don't know.
It's returned.
It always returns. My episode, Emerald, is what you said about history. Like, no one's asking history what he thinks, what he wants. Like, and that's what the whole show is about, is animals and, like, their rights and how they're treated. So I feel like this is an iconic scene, and as you said, like a perfect lead-in to, oh my god, our next episode. I'm gonna need days to like research this. Like everything in the books that we're reading from, it's only like a paragraph on each song, and now
no, Defying Gravity,
Defying
is
Gravity
now like,
has like 10 pages. So
Defying Gravity is the song of Wicked. Like if you had to pick one, it is the song. It actually won the favorite song when they did the encore performance that Kate Farner forgot she was part of, that we outed her on.
We outed her.
It won from audience, but it definitely, I think it's one of the most done performance songs. If you can sing this song, you are a singer. It's like one of those like feat songs too, in so many ways. I'm gonna let this sit with myself going into the next episode of the enemy that we're all fighting, like behind all the curtains. And for me, I think what we are consistently fighting, like, of course, like white supremacy, I think is one of the biggest culprits of everything. But even beyond that, I think there's even more of a wizard behind white supremacy. And I think white supremacy is a mask for the wealth divide that we have, the gap. Because we have made this a world where you need money to have an enjoyable life. It's actually been scientifically proven. Like you need a certain amount of money to have happiness, which is sad.
That is crazy.
Not like fully, but like if you can't take the stress that comes from not being able to pay certain things, will wipe out a morning sunset. What am I saying? A morning sunrise being like joy for you to take. Because, you know, there are things like of God, quote unquote, of nature that we can all enjoy.
Yeah.
But those cannot be seen because of the pains that come from having maybe, I don't know, a low income. So I think that's the number one enemy. Like that is the number one enemy, but we get distracted by, like, I recently saw like a racist incident happen on my block. And like, it was between two oppressed backgrounds coming at each other. And I'm like, this is sad. Like, it's just sad. And it's like at the bottom of this isn't the culprit. You know what I mean?
I think that's a good point to end on of, who the enemy is and how maybe the enemy tries to even disguise.
This is why you got a battle cry. It's all too
thank
much.
Thank you, Tara. Thank you for this discussion.
Thank you, sentimental woman.
Thank you, sentimental woman, sentimental men. And we will see you in the next episode.
I am a sentimental man.
That's what it is.
That's how it goes.
Bye, listeners.
All right, bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening to Down the Yellow Brick Pod. We love linking arms with listeners like you.
Another special thank you to our Patreon Pod Squad members who have become our Bellina soup for the soul. Do you get it? And Oz family all across the globe. Consider joining us for as low as $3 a month. Patreon linked in show notes. More tiers and perks coming soon.
You can also find us over on IG at Down the Yellow Brick Pod and someday TikTok, and dropping Good Trouble Witch merch like it's hot on our Etsy shop, all links below. Shout out to our logo designer, Maddie Frank, for helping us make Oz Nerddom fashion.
we'd like to dedicate this season to the late great co-host Drew of the neighboring podcast of Slippers and Spindles, whose fairy tale enthusiasm always inspired ours. Blessed to have connected on Oz and Wicked and to have known you, Drew.
And lastly, if you are feeling the pod and haven't already, consider leaving us an Apple review. It truly makes our day. Each review also equals an entry into our big blowout end of the season giveaway. You won't want to miss this one, which will be completely swankified.
As always, all previous reviews will also be considered in our entries. We got you, boo.
See you over the rainbow soon.
In a clock tick.